Whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. Hello and welcome to the I Could Never Do That podcast. I'm Carrie Barrett, and these are the stories of people who have gone into the arena and fought hard to achieve the unthinkable in spite of the fact that, yes, sometimes they are scared and do have some insecurities. Are you ready to go in? It's my hope that after hearing some of these interviews with thought leaders and artists, athletes, musicians, and entrepreneurs, that maybe you too will be able to go from, I could never do that, to, you know what? Maybe I can. What an honor it was for me to interview author Caroline Paul about her new book, Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. That book was just released on March 5th, and she joins me today to celebrate that release. And let's be honest, it's no secret that girls and women haven't traditionally had role models for aging as it pertains to exploration and adventure seeking. Even as young girls, we're taught to be careful, while the boys are taught to be strong and brave. It is maddening, I know. And Caroline, a longtime adventurer herself, started to notice the massive decline in the number of women that she would see when she would go out paddleboarding or skateboarding or surfing. And in her late 50s, she was asking herself the questions like, well, first of all, why is this happening? And shouldn't we be able to experience adventure at any age? And that's what Tough Broad seeks to answer with the women Caroline interviews in her book. I'm talking hikers, wing walkers, bird watchers, BMX racers, boogie boarders, and so much more, ranging in age from early 50s all the way up to your 90s. These women, they're not experts, but their experiences and the scientific studies that back them up offer such important insight into our own physical and emotional health as we age, showing that growing older is no reason for women to sell themselves short. And one thing that is clear, adventure doesn't have to be some adrenaline-filled, death-defying act, although there is some of that in this book. No, true adventure and self-fulfillment can start with a walk outside. That the more time you spend outdoors and the more positive view you have on aging, the happier you will be. And yes, that indeed will make you one tough broad. So please welcome Caroline Paul.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for joining me on I Could Never Do That. I was telling you before we hit record that I was going over my questions and I thought, well, let me thumb through my new Outside magazine. And sure enough, there is the profile of you in the most recent Outside magazine. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. That was exciting. I hadn't seen it. So you showed it to me and I was like, oh, okay. Looks good.
Yeah. Here. It shows you in a flight suit and it shows you getting into your gyrocopter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What in the hell is a gyrocopter? What is that?
Well, a gyrocopter is mine's an experimental plane. Looks like a tiny insect. It sort of looks like a helicopter and it flies a little bit like a helicopter and a little bit like a fixed wing plane. And I actually learned to fly it for the book. So perfect.
And I know, yeah, and that's when you fell in love with it. And there were a few things, sports and adventures in the book Tough Broad, which is the book I'm holding in my hand right now, your latest book that just came out on March 5th. There were a few of those activities that you're like, yeah, you know, I think I might sit this one out. But a few.
Just one. Base jumping.
But you are an accomplice.
Yes, I was ground crew for the base jumper for Sean Brokman. I think my family pretty much said, yeah, we don't want you base jumping. We know that you're accident prone, though. I am a pilot and I have experience with parachutes because I'd been a paraglider. So it wasn't, yeah, that was my line. I found my line.
Yeah.
And okay. Because I realized we all have that line, but I included that chapter of interviewing Sean about her base jumping, because I really feel like we need these templates for inspiration. Like, I wasn't going to base jump, but here she was, 52, hucking herself off cliffs. And I thought, and it just made me like, yeah, I could do that too. And I knew that would do that for other people. And indeed, she's just an inspiration.
which leads beautifully into the entrance of this interview, which is, this show is called I Could Never Do That. And I love that you led the book off with that chapter. And I interview people of all walks of life, of all backgrounds, who are out there doing things that most of us say, oh my God, I could never do that. And so many of these women certainly fit that bill. But I almost think that more than just them being aspirational and inspirational, I walked away from this book like almost like it was a mandate, Caroline. Like, this is, you don't have to do base jumping or you don't have to do scuba diving, but you have to find your adventure.
Right. I mean, the subtitle is, it's tough broad, but it's From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. What it is a look at fulfilling aging and the tenets that we need to have fulfilling aging, and how outdoor adventure is just the perfect place, the perfect arena to experience all those almost at once. So, yeah. And so the women, it's not just inspiration. It's actually kind of a template for all of us on, as for me at the time, I was 55 when I thought about this book, about how our aging is going to go and how to optimize it. Because frankly, you probably know this. I mean, the messaging around aging for older women is kind of toxic. It's pretty dark.
Yeah. Yeah. It's self-defeating in many ways. And one of the thesis, or at least the big theme that came out of this book for me, is that the attitude that we go into aging with and how we feel about that aging process is everything. And if you go into this aging process with a positive attitude, with an adventurous attitude, then you will have a better experience.
Yeah. And that's not my idea. Like, that gobsmacked me when I started this book. I did research on fulfilling aging, and I came upon these studies that say how you look at your own aging predicts how well you'll age. So if you have a negative view, you will have cardiac events earlier. You will have cognitive decline earlier. And the opposite is true. If you have an optimistic, view that your own aging is going to be full of exploration and health and connection and novelty, then it will, and you will be healthier and happier, and you live statistically 7 years longer. That was huge. But then, the scientists did not tell us how to get that positive view. So that was it. It's like, you have to have a positive view, but how? I mean, we're told in every arena, like all in all different ways, and we believe it ourselves, that our own aging is a time of frail bones, of cognitive decline, and frankly, we're boring and we believe it. So that was my real question, like, great, really great insight, have a positive view, but how? Just yes. Mantras is not going to work. And what I found is going outside and embracing an activity is a direct rebuke to all that messaging. And so, yes, outdoor adventure in all its many colors is how we can, is probably, in my opinion, the best way to lead a fulfilling life at this
point. Yeah. And I asked permission ahead of time if I could read just a couple of excerpts. And so you really start the book, and this is on page 9, and you say, at some age, it probably lies within a range, many women start believing that they can't or shouldn't be out there as in the out of doors. And that hit me right from the get-go. And then the next page, I turn the page on page 10, and you're talking about adventure. And you say, you're on an adventure when you're reaching for a goal that you've set, feeling physically and mentally engaged, maybe learning something new. It's when you're pushing your comfort zone and experiencing exhilaration and having fun, always fun. I mean, that is the way you started the book. And then it goes into these stories of these women who are doing just that. How do you describe adventure, especially now that this book is wrapped up and it's out in the world, and you know these women now intimately? How do you describe their adventures?
I came into this book with a fairly narrow view of adventure. I mean, I really thought it kind of had to almost kill you, and you had to have high adrenaline. And you look at I was been a whitewater raft guide. I did first descents around the world when I was young, and then I sea kayaked around the world. I bike packed around the world. I mean, it was true that my definition of adventure was, it had to really be fairly extreme. So when I went into this book, I wanted to make it accessible to everybody because I believe so strongly that just getting outside is so medicinal, which it is. The studies are clear that, bird song is really good for our brains. The sort of the lines of the outdoors are really good for us because they match perfectly with the way our eyes are structured. I mean, there's some really deep science on how important just nature is for us medicinally. So I wanted to get people outside. So I was like, you know what? Let's go bird watching. It's not an adventure, but and so I went and met Virginia Rose of Birdability, and Virginia's in a wheelchair. She's been in one since she was 14. And so I wanted to really discuss in the book about adapting as we age, because of course there can be there's inevitably some physical decline. It's not as precipitous as you think, but of course. And she told me, like, if we're all lucky, you will be here where I am now, if you're lucky. And she's right. So I went bird watching with her, but I was like, this isn't an adventure. And then I realized, oh, we are on a quest looking for birds. There's that sense of exhilaration, anticipation, long stretches of boredom too, physical vitality. We actually did 6 miles. She wheeled, I walked, because we were on a bird-a-thon. And I realized, oh, you know what? You really have to expand your definition of adventure. And so, yes, getting outside and bird watching, or even just walking in the park, is an adventure.
Yeah, and you did that in here in Austin, Texas, which is where I live most of the year. And as I was telling you, I was reading that chapter on a Sunday morning. It was the first day of daylight savings, and I thought I'm just going to stay in bed a little bit longer because the sun hadn't come up yet. And I'm reading that chapter, and you're describing some of the calls of the birds and some of the chirps, and I could hear the birds in my neighborhood start to wake up and give their cries and say their good mornings. And I felt that, and I was lying in bed. Like it was so exciting to marry what you were writing about and experience it from my home.
That's
So
beautiful. That's beautiful.
yeah. And so why do you think, what are some of these reasons? And I'm 51, and so I am foggy brain deep in perimenopause at this point. And so I'm at that intersection of very firmly still trying to prove myself as like a hardcore athletic woman versus this, I don't have shit to prove anymore. And why am I trying to do all this stuff? Just calm down. It's okay. You're allowed to just chill. So what are some of the reasons why that we shrink as we age when it comes to adventure?
I mean, I think the biggest reason is the messaging we get about our sort of inevitable, our quick, precipitous decline physically. We also, I mean, again, I saw men my age out there when I was skateboarding or flying my experimental plane or on a surfboard. I would look around, there were men out there and older, up into their 70s out there on cold winter ocean waves. So I really think the messaging that we get is very particular and very toxic, and we believe it. And I also think that it starts super young. I mean, we are not schooled in this idea of pushing our comfort zones like men are. And I hope that has started to change. But really, we're parented to be scared because they think that's going to protect us. Be on guard. Be wary, and not just for the stranger or the dark alley, but also our own and our own like physical health. They've done studies, and I've written about this, about where they looked at moms and dads on the playground, specifically around a fire pole, that they watched them coach their daughters on, and basically they cautioned their daughters against using this playground fire pole. If they still wanted to use it, they would help them. And so the exact opposite with boys. If boys were in any way trepidatious, they would urge them to go on it and urge them to do it on their own. And this study is eye-opening because what it basically says is that we don't think girls are strong enough, which is patently untrue at this age. I think they were around six. Girls are stronger than boys and more mature, and yet we're already messaging to them that they aren't. And we are already teaching boys to push past their comfort zones, try new things, and do it on their own. So it starts super early. You know, the messaging that we get later is different, but nevertheless, it's all in the same vein. And that I think is our biggest issue. And yet I think we also know that we want a life of like pizzazz and excitement and exploration. So
yeah, I feel like I think you talked about this in one of your previous books, Gutsy Girl, and it speaks to what you just said, which is girls are messaged to be careful, whereas boys are messaged to be brave. Mm-hmm. And I know that as we age, I know certainly from my perspective, there is a hormone shift. And, you know, as that estrogen starts to droop, you do have more anxiety, and things that didn't scare you, quote unquote, before, even on a mountain bike, because I love to mountain bike and I love to trail run, and things that I used to do in my 30s and 40s, I am so much more trepidatious now. And there is a, you know, innate fear of injury, of course. But then there's this like silly fear of feeling like you're going to suck at something and you don't want to try something new because you're afraid that you're going to look silly. And that bothers me, especially as somebody who is 51, and these women in this book, they don't seem to have that. They don't care what people are saying, or they don't care what they look like. In fact, you know, you chronicle a few of the women who are women of color, very rare in the spaces that they inhabit. And they're like, great, this is who I am. And they're very proud to be in that space.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we create, I'm sorry you're in perimenopause. I feel like this is going to change. It's sort of an upheaval. You're kind of going through adolescence right now. So understand it. It's understandable that, but I found, and I personally experienced this too, that as I aged, and I'm in menopause, I'm 60. So that I feel actually like I really don't care. Like I don't have to be good anymore. And I don't have as much to prove. And I found that with other women too. I remember when I talked to, I was interested in how novelty was important to us as we age, something else that falls away. Most of us do not learn something new. And so I interviewed a woman who had learned to swim at a late age. She was 68. And she told me that she didn't care about how she looked. She kind of said, look at me, there's bulges all over and I don't care. I probably would not have tried to swim younger if it had been offered to me because of simple things like that, like how I look. And I feel like this is one of the reasons that embracing an outdoor activity is so great at this age, because we have so much less emotional baggage. It will come. I promise you, Carrie, it'll come.
I love to hear that.
And that's just endocrinological. I mean, I'm not a hormonologist or whatever the term is, but I do have done research in it, and our hormones change such that these intense connection hormones that have enabled us to be great caregivers and empathetic to our environment are changing. And we're not less empathetic, we're not less caregiving, but it's been switched, and now we're doing it for ourselves. And so I think a lot of that concern starts to fall away.
Yes, and that was one of the quotes in the book that I actually underlined, is when that changes to where you're not doing life for everybody else in the world, you finally get to a point in your life where you're doing it for yourself. And Dot, our hiker, how old was Dot when you...
She was 93 and a pistol. And I was terrified of going on a walk with her. I have like injuries, like not because I'm old. I got these injuries when I was a firefighter in my 40s. And so I'm kind of creaky. And I said, could we not go on a 5-mile hike up a peak called Grizzly? And she said, "What's wrong? You look robust," because she'd seen my TED talk. And so she's, and I was all like, I know that you're 30 years older than me," but she agreed to take me on a 3 mile jaunt through the suburban town she lived in.
And she calls you out in this book because at the time you were 57 when you wrote this particular chapter. And she was like, "Old? You're not old," she exclaimed. "It's ridiculous. Pardon my extreme language. It's ridiculous to me that at 57, you could be thinking about how to keep going. Just do what you've always done. It gets better as you get older." What
Yeah,
a takeaway.
I know. I know. Amazing. Like, I had started this book, like, "How is my elder age going to be?" And she was like, "What are you talking about?" And actually, some of the other women were like that too. It was almost like they had embraced this idea. They were impervious to the messaging almost. And maybe because they'd been the women that were had been outside most of their lives.
Was that a prevailing sentiment among these women of it just keeps getting better as you get older?
Without a doubt, like, these women, to a person who were older than me, said the 60s was their best decade. And here I was on the cusp of 60 at the time. So, and that's not what society thinks. They're like, "Oh no, it's the dewy 20s, the striving 30s, and or the 40s when you have your family and your purpose." I don't know. Not true for these women. The 60s were the best decade.
Yep. And I honestly, I can't wait. I literally am going into these years of my life with such a positive attitude. And I know I'll probably wrap up a little bit more about that, talking about, your mom and my mom, who have been such great examples of how to be as you age, because my mom is in her mid-80s and still gardens and mows the lawn and walks miles every day. And so, like, it's such a great example. And she would never call herself an adventurer, but she is outside every day, every day. And I think that that is a lesson for all of us. On page 97, I wrote down on my note card, I wrote down my thoughts exactly. And it says, "I like the person I have become. However, I am dismayed by what seems to be a new and unfamiliar disinterest in daredevilry. I can't tell if it's the sedating effect of the pandemic or just the normal evolution of aging or perhaps something particular to my own growth as a person. All I know is that I'm no longer as piqued by adrenaline. Roller coaster ride, no thank you. Big white water, I'll pass. Night in with my wife next to me and cats on my lap, definitely."
I know it was, and it was a little disturbing to me because it was it had been my sort of identity. Not, I wasn't trumpeting all the things I did, but people knew, and I realized I was sort of like, "Man, it doesn't really interest me to be petrified all the time." And so, but I learned through this book that what I'd actually been seeking.
Which is what, like, is it? It's a different style of adventure. It seems to be leading to this sense of awe. And you talk a lot about awe, AWE, in the book. What are your thoughts around finding that in your daily life?
Well, first of all, I had no concept of what awe was. Now I know books are out about it, but by the time I handed my book in, it was just starting to pop, this idea. And awe is basically that sense of wonder and awareness of mystery, and it's often triggered by things being in the presence of things bigger than you or more mysterious under the night sky. Well, it's been traditionally associated with religion for because of God is that inspires awe. Well, I actually came upon awe ironically when I went wing walking, and wing walking is, I mean, not it's not really a, you don't become a wing walker, you just do wing walking. Yeah, it's on the cover of the book. But I was sent a video and I saw this woman named Cynthia Hicks. She was 71, and I watched her take off in a biplane and climb up on the wing in the while they were in midair and then attach herself to the king post in the middle. And I had to talk to her and call her. And she said, "Caroline, you wouldn't believe." Oh, so let me just say that wing walking is something that they used to do in the 1920s with the biplanes. They used to call it barnstorming, and they actually did go through a barn, but they did a lot of tricks. And one of them was that people would walk on the wing and they would maybe transfer midair, wing to wing, two planes, or from the ground, a moving car to a plane. Yeah, we don't do it anymore for understandable reasons, but there is one place in Washington called Mason Wing Walking that will teach you to do that. And I was interested because I thought, what does that do to us, our neural system, as we age, to just really break out of our box and do one pretty extreme thing? Skydiving is another thing people do. I was curious how that would help us. So that's why I actually got in touch with her. And then she said, Caroline, the courage you feel when you get on the wing is amazing. And I thought, oh, okay, well, now I have to go do this, which I did not want to do because I'm a pilot. Like, why would I get out of a perfectly good cockpit? I have no idea. But I did. And I was very reluctant, even all the way to like when I pulled myself on the wing. And it's not wing walking, by the way. It is like wing crawling, wing slithering. I mean, we had practiced this on the ground multiple times, like all morning, all into the afternoon, because the instructor said, look, it's going to be about muscle memory. And I was like, well, it better be, because at 3,000 feet, like, I don't think I'm going to have a brain. Yeah. So, and she was right. She was right. Marilyn Mason was herself a wing walker. She's actually a wing walker. And she was correct. And I got on the, slithered along the wing, attached myself to the king post. And then the pilot at 3,000 feet starts doing loops, hammerheads, and barrel rolls. And it was, I transformed from this reluctant wing walker to being ecstatic. And my mind is really blown because, of course, I had never experienced anything like this before, which is what awe is. It's kind of this, they call it a reset for your brain sometimes. So awe, and I realized later that's what I was experiencing, not adrenaline. I mean, there was obviously adrenaline, but really what had completely captured me was awe. And I did more research about it, and turns out awe is, first of all, really easily accessed in the outdoors. So that's one reason why the outdoors is so great. But you do not have to get on a wing to experience awe. And they did a study here in San Francisco where they asked people between 60 and 80 to go on walks and simply look at things with childlike wonder. Because that, and they called them awe walks, because you can induce awe yourself. And they saw after 8 weeks that the biological health markers for these people had completely changed. Their inflammatory markers had improved and their anxiety had gone down. And just on all these different levels, it was medicinal for them. So getting outside is, and I'd realized when I was with, bird watching or on my walk with Dot Fisher Smith, that I was experiencing awe during those walks because I was with people who were paying close attention and being excited and exhilarated by what they saw, which is a trigger for awe.
Childlike wonder. I love that. And I think that that's why as humans, we all love to see a sunrise and we all love to see a sunset because it's just this overwhelming beauty that no words can really describe what you're seeing. And that is one easy way of experiencing awe every day.
And here's the thing, a lot of our indoor devices are, they call them anti-awe devices, like our phone or our computer, because it's like a screen, it's a small funneling into this little tiny arena where you're the center of it. That's anti-awe right there, because awe is about understanding that you're part of something way bigger, which is beautiful. Like, who wants to be the center all the time? No.
Yes, yes. And the you talked earlier about Britta, our wing walk. No, she was our gyrocopter. Right?
Instructor. Yeah, Britta. She was my instructor.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. And she said, you talked about this earlier of why not me? You know, it's my time. And she actually says, we've had years of things like marriage or children or a big career and just making ends meet. Now we're turning our sights to what about me? What brings me joy? And that goes into that sense of awe and joy that, as you say, it's like you don't have to get on a wing to experience. All you have to do is take a 30-minute walk with the eyes of a child.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, music can also give you awe, a poem, You know, sitting, listening to someone sing, that's all awe-inspiring too. But the thing about outdoor adventure is it offers all these other things too at the same time. Whereas you're engaging yourself physically, which is super important as we age, you're accessing community often, you know, you're often novelty, like with Vijaya, the swimmer, or when I went wing walking, you know, novelty is so important. So yes, all, but then all these other things.
The chapter about swimming was really profound for me because I do a lot of triathlons, and while I quote unquote swam as a child, it was more like splashing around and getting dunked by my four brothers, and so it wasn't really swimming, and so I didn't really learn how to swim until I was an adult, and that is a very fearful place. And one thing that I noticed, intentionally or unintentionally on your part, were that that some of the chapters alternated between these big things, you know, wing walking, for example, and then things that maybe aren't as big in life, you know, learning how to swim as an adult, but it's still an adventure. And it's still getting out of your comfort zone and challenging your brain and body as we age. Was there intention behind kind of alternating these stories of these women?
I definitely didn't want someone to put the book down because they were like, oh, base jumping. Yeah, not going to do that. Put it down. I was even nervous about starting with base jumping for that reason. But I hope I made it clear pretty soon that I wasn't going to do it. So come with me and read about it because it's still inspirational. Yeah, I definitely wanted people to understand that it's your outdoor adventure. As long as it has these sort of general precepts to it, like exhilaration, exploration, novelty, all the things you were reading from the book, that's an adventure. So I felt like that was, first of all, something that I learned, but also really important for people so that they could take what they would from the adventures they wouldn't do. Because, you know, I interviewed Diane Espeldon, amazing person who began her outdoor life at an older age because she had a daughter she wanted to keep up with, which is not uncommon for women. They want to keep up with their kids. And she had had no outdoor experience and she wanted to swim, but she didn't actually succeed in swimming. And I kept writing about it anyway, because I thought it was important, first of all, to see that the journey was really still important, but also that sometimes it isn't going to fulfill you, or isn't something that you're actually going to do. But Diane's life was full anyway. She was still hiking in Japan. She was still camping to watch the eclipse. I mean, she had got herself an outdoor life. It just so happened that swimming wasn't going to be it for her. And I interviewed another swimmer for whom it was incredibly, she's still a swimmer. She learned at 68 and is at 74 when I met her, was, you know, still swimming, met me with the really cool, like, swim jacket on.
Yeah,
I got out earlier than she did, yeah. You know? And so I wanted to show that there's still things, it's nothing's a failure. It's none of it's a failure. It's like the journey was still great for Diane and she has a full life. She wasn't losing anything by deciding not to swim.
Right, right. And the other thing that I took away from this book was there was almost an inherent sense of humor from the women, and, you know, to where almost without fail, you know, in every chapter it was, what do you mean you're afraid? You just got to do it. Who cares what people like? I liked that they approached their adventures with seriousness and with the sense of awe, but yet there's also like an inherent sense of humor. And I picked up on that in your writing as well. And there were a couple of lines that literally made me spit out my coffee. And one of them is, as a reformed Catholic girl, you might know exactly where I'm going with this one. It's where you are on paddle boards with your friend Sue and her son. And she's talking about her dog Pearl. And you say, you were on some pretty rough water at this point in the chapter. And you say, behind Sue is her little dog Pearl, resplendent in a red and yellow life jacket, looking unhappy. Her rat terrier legs are wide. She has gotten the hang of balancing, but it's clear she doesn't understand why her human wants to be out there. Every so often, water sprays up from the sides, and Pearl half closes her eyes and turns her head with the repressed outrage of a nun. That killed me.
I'm glad.
Yeah, because I can just see this little wet dog who is probably shivering, just like giving mom the side eye in that moment. And if you could share a little bit about Sue's story, because yes, you are talking about an adventure, being on your boards, on the water, but she also had to go through another adventure in her life that was somewhat unexpected.
Yeah, I wanted to quickly, just one thing that you said about fear and how these women just were like, I'm going to do it anyway. I want to say that people bring up fear a lot with me with outdoor adventure, and fear is always an element, but it's just part of the experience. And of course, it's part of life. And I say to people, look, going outside is so good for you. Do not let fear be the reason you're not doing it. We take pharmaceuticals every day with terrible side effects that they list for minutes on the television. And yet we're willing to still take that pill because supposedly it's going to cure whatever it is that ails us. And we're going to have to deal with those side effects. Well, fear is a side effect of an incredibly medicinal, going outside is a pharmaceutical with a very mild side effects. That's all
there
I
you go.
That.
Yes. There you go. There you go.
I was interested in covering Sue because she had faced a very abrupt change late in her life. And I knew that these kind of swerves happen as we age, and it's scary. And I wanted to see how she had handled that through the outdoors and how the outdoors had helped her negotiate that. And she was an outdoors person, by the way. And one of the few friends I actually wrote about, because again, didn't want to write a lot about my own friends because it's a big responsibility. But I decided to write about Sue because what had happened with her is that at age 57, her twin brother had a baby, and he was ill-equipped to raise the baby. And so at this late age, Sue adopted Seth. She essentially became a mother at 57, which is not unusual in some ways. A lot of parents go back and parent their grandchildren, for instance, but Sue had never been a mother. She was a lesbian who grew up when there was no sense that you would have kids. She was 64 when I interviewed her. And, she had lived a life that was incredibly well-managed. And suddenly, I mean, she planned everything. And suddenly in comes the most chaotic element that anybody can have in a life, which is a little three-year-old. And she had become a mother. And so I wanted to talk to her about how the outdoors had helped her. Mm. And we went on a stand-up paddleboards and went camping with Seth, who's now lovely 12-year-old, and Sue. And she told me about her anxieties. And as a parent, it was an odd intersection to be at, because she was at once a newish parent. I mean, he was 12, but I had tracked her throughout this change. And yet she was also facing what it was like to be 64.
On this brand new adventure with a 12-year-old boy. And I love that she has made outdooring still a priority for the two of them.
It was a way for her to burn off his energy and for her to find her own stability again. Because frankly, when you're a mother of a young kid at almost 60, there are no parents who can really relate to your situation. Not really. You know, she's like, I'm almost 60 and these parents are in their 20s. And so that sort of posse that you can sometimes find to support you through this was just no longer there. It was not there for her. And her friends who had been parents were like, yeah, we're done with that. We're not. I mean, it was a journey. So thank you for highlighting that chapter. That chapter was really moving for me.
Yeah. It was moving for me as well. As somebody who doesn't have children, and it's kind of another one of those, I could never do that moments for me, and reading that chapter and going, could I do that? Could I do what she did? Which was pick up the mantle for her twin and help him through a tough time as well, and mother this young son, and she seems to be doing a beautiful job. I want to meet Sue and Seth. I really do. Talk about play. I think that that's one thing, again, as we get older and we start to age, we don't even know what play is anymore. And it's sad and it makes me angry. And, you know, play used to just be reckless abandon, going out there for no purpose. And you even define it in your book on page 237. Actually, you did it. Researcher Stuart Brown says it's participating in an activity with no clear function, just for the immediate pleasure of it, inviting improvisation, triggering happiness, and experiencing a suspension of a sense of time. Where can we get play? Why have we lost play?
Well, because all those characteristics are things that women don't allow themselves. I mean, and also, especially what you called reckless abandon. I mean, what I was struck by the aspects of play, I write about it when I go visit the boogie boarders in San Diego. They call themselves the Wave Chasers. They are in, they are between 60s, 70s, 80s, even 90s. And boogie boarding is basically sort of riding waves on your stomach on a cafeteria tray like board. It's a very simple sport. It's really associated with kids. So mm-hmm. I have to say, as a surfer, I went in there like, yeah, I don't know. Is this really something? But I was interested because I thought it would be adaptable again, something easy to learn at a later age. And instead, again, overwhelmed by the new things I was learning and the humility that I needed about the fact that first and foremost, the very simplicity was the beauty of it, because it stripped away all that need to be, you know, skillful at something. You just had to go in there with the right attitude and jump on the board and get, you know, thrown in by a wave. And it was elemental play, which I realized we have so little in our lives as adults because we think of it as not being important. Whereas Stuart Brown talks a lot about how important it is. I mean, there's a lot of different types of play, but I think boogie boarding comes under what we call rough and tumble play, which mimics like dogs in a dog park, where it sort of looks like they might be fighting, but it's not. It's all calibrated. It's really about connection, bonding, and understanding limits and enjoying yourself, having fun. And I saw this on the waves with women when I went in with them. They taught me to boogie board, and we would all catch a wave and just start laughing. And the word that came to mind was unruly. There's an unruliness about this sort of physical vitality. It's a cold ocean and it's throwing you around and you're having so much fun and you're just laughing. And as Fran Dyer said, who started the Wave Chasers, she said, look, out here, all you have to do is laugh. Like, there's no one trying to get your attention. There's no phone calls to pick up. You just have to have fun. And that was life-changing for many of those women there.
Yeah, that was of all of the, you know, chapters, that was definitely one of the ones with the Wave Chasers and the boogie boarding that I knew. I was like, I want to do that. I want to hop on a wave and just ride it in on my stomach and laugh and get flipped around as you hit the shore. And that felt so fun to me. And you know, there are so many of that, like Virginia and the bird watching. We talked about how that was so magical for me to be reading that as I was listening to the birds in my home, and Cynthia and the wing walking, and Britta and the gyroplane. We have Penny, who did some orienteering. That also sounded great. It sounded terrible for you, but it sounded great for me.
Orienteering is running with a map and compass. We walked, but it's basically a very obscure sport. But I was interested in one of the things we worry about as we age is our memory. And I was interested in how outdoors can improve your memory. And in fact, navigation and memory are in the same part of the brain. And they have shown that if you beef up your navigation skills, you are immensely helping your memory. So I wanted to find someone who navigated. And so I hit upon orienteering, and Penny DeMoss, who was 72 and luckily had just broken her foot. So she could only walk the course. Thank the Lord, because we just, it was fun. We basically just you know, broke trail through thistles, and she was tough, like not complaining. So I wasn't complaining either, of course, but you know, she was very patient with me. And it was a really amazing experience. And it just goes to show, as someone who, first of all, is always lost myself, and you know, we're so dependent on GPS. This is something that all of us should be thinking about, because if when we lose our navigation skills, we lose our ability to orient ourselves, we will be losing our ability to retain other information. There's a great book, if I could plug, Wayfinding, by M.R. O'Connor. I can't remember the subtitle, but it's really good. And it talks a lot about this.
I did one adventure race a couple of years ago with some girlfriends, and it was a combination of like mountain biking with some orienteering. There was running involved, and then you had to canoe, and it was like you were finding checkpoints along the way. So they give you a map and they say, go. And it was great because, like you described in that chapter, you're trying to find out whether you should go the quickest way, which might not always be the easiest way to get from point A to point B, or you go the more circuitous route and you're having fun and this and that. And it not only did it invoke a massive sense of play because you're out there like a treasure hunt, but it also invoked this, as you say, this deep sense of like brain work, because you are trying to assess, you know, do we go the shortest way, or do we navigate here and try to pick this one up first and this, and you're plotting against
the shortest way was often the hardest way, but the longest way was easier, so you could go faster. So it's that calculation. Penny always wanted to go the shortest because she knew she was really good at it. And I would always have a lot of bravado. Let's go the way you go. And then immediately be scrabbling up a steep side of a hill. I want to say that I learned many things during the research of this book and going on these adventures, is that, you know, it improves our thinking because we do not think like a computer. We think with our body. And they've done studies that show that if you add a kinetic experience to your thinking, it makes you massively more creative. So, you know, a lot of scientists will doodle, or they actually make, you know, physical models, or they walk and think. That's very common, that Einstein was a big walker, because it activated him in ways that made him more creative. So getting outside, so, you know, running with a map and compass, you're thinking and navigating and exercising, is kind of amazing.
Yeah, it is the trifecta there. And one of the other adventures that you got to go on was you were in a BMX race with Miss Kitty.
The oldest female BMX bike racer in the country. She was 74 and amazing. Yeah.
And I what I found that was a little sad at the, you know, sort of the end of that chapter, you basically say she's racing in age categories all by herself at this point, because there are no other women that are in her age group yet.
Yeah, the thing I loved about BMX bike racing, which by the way is not like doing flips in the air, which I thought it was, and she corrected me. She's like, Caroline, you watch a little too much TV. She's an ex-principal. So what I loved about her is she had all these sort of teachable moments all the time, often in rhyme. She was really, really smart and, frankly, pretty famous in the BMX circuit. People came up to her just to be able to shake her hand. And she had that whole sort of teacher, you know, connection with kids. It was sort of proverbial bringing her apples all the time.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, she was amazing. And one of her goals was to bring more women into the sport, because it had been frustrating to her that she was the only one racing. She started at 40, again, late, when her own son was a BMX racer and she was trying to coach him from the sidelines, even though she'd never done it. And he said, if you think it's so easy, why don't you come do it? So as she told me, I put Pat and Charlie in the street, which means she put her money where her mouth is.
Yeah.
I think Pat and Charlie are her feet. And I did it, and she fell in love with it.
And was doing it decades later, which I love. You know, this book, there were so many lessons, so many of which we've talked about already, and you sum them up in these almost pillars, if you will, of finding outdoor adventure and how it can improve our lives as we age. And you know, just to sort of loosely summarize some of the lessons that I took away from all of it, was
finding things that get out of your comfort zone, whether it is trying to learn to swim for the first time, get on a BMX bike or the wing of an airplane, find something that gets you out of your daily comfort zone. Was that one of the takeaways that you found?
Definitely. But now you're going to scare people because they're going to be like, oh, I like my comfort zone, which I kind of understand. So there's other things that that will sort of lure you into a great outdoor experience. And also you will want to push your comfort zone because you want more of that. So outdoor adventure offers purpose. It offers novelty. It offers community. And it offers physical vitality, which is something we definitely, we're happy to be in a gym. Well, go in a gym. Gyms are great. I use a gym. But if it's physical vitality you're after, there's nothing more holistic than going outside and feeling the wind and, you know, walking up the steep hill and then seeing the wild animal that surprises you. I mean, so in terms of, yeah, so yes, definitely pushes your comfort zone, but that will be easy for you once you're out there.
Mm-hmm. And as you alluded to as well, finding something that is novel, it might not be that adrenaline rush of jumping, you know, off of El Capitan, but the bird watching is getting out of your comfort zone if that's something that's new to you or if it is novel to you. So finding something that is novel, as you say, and boy, what I really took away more than anything is finding that community. There are like the boogie boarders, the wave chasers,
and my own mom.
Yes, with her cycling. And I would love to sort of wrap it up of you telling the story of your mom that you mentioned in this book, but you also had an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently. And talking about how getting a bike in your mom's 40 at the age of, you know, in her 40s changed everything for your mom.
Well, she got the bike in her 50s, actually. It was when in her 60s that she started bicycling, but she had been blossoming as a person after her 40s. And I saw that as her kid, but it was she was my own subliminal message, to be honest, about how great aging was. And in particular, it was when she was 60, she got on a bike. And it was she only got on it because she had just broken up with her boyfriend of 20 years. Often this happens where, you know, it could be the pandemic, could be a breakup, could be, you know, some sort of thing shakes you up and you're more willing somehow to get outside the neural grooves about what you expect. And she decided, well, maybe if I get on this old bike that I got, I don't really know how to ride, but I'll join this group. And they were made up of 60, 70, and 80-year-olds. And she found that she fell in love with cycling. And through cycling, suddenly, by upending her own sense of what she could and could not do, she suddenly was open to all these other experiences, which is something I saw in all the women that I interviewed. But one of the things that biking offered her that surprised us, her kids, was she had this, she became so much more social and connected, and we could feel it in her interactions with us. And it was very subversive. She did not look, she wasn't actually looking for new friends. She just wanted a distraction and some sort of foothold in this new town she had moved to. She wasn't actually very social. And but with biking came all these people that she went on bike trips with. And she said it was the perfect sort of kind of etiquette for her because she didn't like cocktail parties with all the small talk. With a bike, the etiquette is you're biking with someone, you stop if they, you know, need the tire changed, you slow if they are slower than you, you stop for lunch when people want to. You know, it was kind of a social interaction that could start her off in a way that she was comfortable with. And she said, oh, and if you didn't like someone, you could just bike away from them. So but on a subtle level, she began making all these connections because you do connect with the people that you're up going up steep hills with or seeing new towns with or caught in the rain with. And so in between 60 and 80, when she was biking, she really became, I won't say a new person, but she became like her best self.
Mm. Mm. And what activities in your life have made you become your best self?
I mean, everyone. I mean, that's why I wrote this book, kind of. I started like, oh my goodness, I don't see women out here. Am I going to have to give up these adventures that I go on? Because I feel like they make me a better person, because they I have to access courage. I have to access patience. I have to access risk assessment, you know, all these cool things. I didn't want to give it up. So I think I would say, but I will say that as I get older, I am happy with mini adventures. I can take my paddleboard just out here to the bay, right at the bottom of, you know, the hill that I live on in San Francisco, and just go paddling. I don't need to go to another country anymore. I get all the sense of adventure and exploration from just a micro adventure outside.
Thank you, Caroline, for writing this book, for providing, and to the women in the book. I owe a sincere debt of gratitude, because they have really helped define where I want to go as I age and as I navigate this next chapter in life. And I appreciate you spelling it out and just reaffirming that it doesn't have to be grand. It doesn't have to be massive. You just have to get outside, and it could save your life. It really could. And so it's Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. And of course, available anywhere you buy books.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun.
Her book, Tough Broad, is available wherever you find your favorite books. And I want to reiterate some of the themes that came out of her research. Things like seek new experiences that challenge your brain and your body. Find a network and a community of people who are doing the things that you want to do. And most importantly, and most simply, get outside. Yes, our bodies are changing, but that doesn't mean that you can't approach your life with a sense of awe, wonder, and play. It's time to become a tough broad. Thanks for listening and supporting this independent podcast. You can show your support by leaving a small donation, and I'll link up how to do that in the show notes. Okay, time to get outside and play. So I will see you next time on I Could Never Do That.